Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. I'll be your guide as we go through this, Part 3, Chapter 11 of Libido Dominandi, and this will concern Washington in 65 and Rome in 65 as well. About 20 pages, 423 to, I think, 53. As always, you can find what we record at vnnforum.com, also at alexlinder.com when it's permanently archived. Let's dig in. Emboldened by the sense that they now had a combination of state-of-the-art contraceptive devices at their disposal, John D. Rockefeller III and the Population Council began to press their advantage. Within days of Johnson's landslide victory in November of 1964, and right around the time Daniel Patrick Moynihan was mulling over the plight of the black family, Rockefeller and Bernard Berelson traveled to Washington seeking an audience with Lyndon Baines Johnson. What they got was a meeting with Dean Rusk, Secretary of State under John F. Kennedy, and the Rockefeller operative who had pulled the plug on the Kinsey when Kinsey's sex surveys became a matter of public embarrassment in the wake of the Reese hearings. Through Rusk's ministrations, a sentence was inserted into Johnson's January 4, 1965 State of the Union message, in which the president announced to the world that he would, quote, seek new ways to use our knowledge to help deal with the explosion in world population and the growing scarcity in world resources. Rockefeller's biographers see the statement as a decisive turning point in changing the public's aversion to contraception and paving the way for the government's involvement in disseminating at first information about contraception, and then the contraceptives themselves. Griswold v. Connecticut, handed down in the early summer of 1965, was another crucial step in this process. Writing after the victory had been safely won, Leo Pfeffer was completely candid in explaining why a law prohibiting the sale of contraceptives, which never got enforced, had to be struck down. This was so, quote, because their presence made it impossible for the state to encourage contraception, something it now increasingly deems necessary to do. The middle income and affluent, married and unmarried, use contraceptives. The poor have babies. When the poor, often racial minorities, are on the welfare rolls, taxpaying Americans rebel and expect the state to do something about it. The national government already established this policy as part of its program of aid to underdeveloped countries, but the states could hardly follow suit as long as their own laws forbade the practice. The liberals were, in effect, playing a double game here. They were using race to overturn the notion that the social order was somehow dependent on the moral order, and then they were using the loosened sexual morals as a way of prosecuting a eugenics campaign against the same blacks who had made that loosening possible in the first place. The South had condoned segregation, and they were all Christians. Therefore, Christianity had been discredited as a force with anything to say about how this society should be structured. The mainline Protestant denominations were completely in agreement with this strategy, even if it seemed on the surface to be to their detriment, because they were just as avid for sexual liberation. To the extent that the mainline Protestants capitulated on the sexual front, they sought to compensate by increasing their efforts for racial justice. Part two of the double game had to do with eugenics. Once the social order had been weakened by the liberals using race as a cover for sexual liberation, contraceptives were prescribed as a cure for welfare by cutting back on the number of blacks, i.e. welfare recipients, that were being born. The blacks, who were used as the pretext to change social mores, became the first victims of the change as they were targeted by the population controllers as the, quote, beneficiaries of expanded government services, which were more often than not just a pretext for the legitimization of contraceptive eugenics. Griswold v. Connecticut was the major breakthrough in this regard. Now the government could push forward with its population control programs without coming into conflict with state laws. Perhaps emboldened by this string of stunning success, JDR III decided to take his struggle for contraception a step further. He decided to confront the enemy in his own lair. With the help of Father Theodore Hesburgh, president of the University of Notre Dame and board member of the Rockefeller Foundation, JDR III arranged an audience with Pope Paul VI, who was mulling over the issue of birth control at the time, and, it was hoped, according to the Enlightenment view of history, might prove to be even more liberal than John XXIII, who was as different from his predecessor as day was from night. Hesburgh, who is described as decidedly liberal in his own views on population, although he would not go as far as JDR in some aspects, was only too happy to oblige. After being briefed by a number of Jesuit professors from Georgetown University on, quote, the complexities of the Catholic Church that curtail the freedom of any pope, Rockefeller met with Pope Paul VI for 45 minutes in mid-July of 1965. I'm not sure if this is the one that just died. I suspect it may be at 101. Years later, in a letter to Henry Cabot Lodge, the man who arranged for the murder of Ngo Dinh Diem, the Catholic president of Vietnam, when Lodge was appointed U.S. emissary to the Vatican, Rockefeller described the meeting as warm and friendly, but at the same time not too meaningful or constructive in terms of the population question, as I did not feel that I could push too hard, and he obviously could not be entirely frank with me as to his own personal views when he had the major decision on birth control pending. The decision in question, as expressed in the papal document, which would eventually come out under the name Humanae Vitae, in 1968, must have been a bitter disappointment for Rockefeller. 5 years after his meeting with the Pope, and 2 years after the appearance of Humane Vitae, I think that's a misspelling, Rockefeller was still obsessed with the Church's opposition to birth control. So much so that he was willing to trade in his friendship with Lodge as a way of getting his point across to the same Pope who had so pointedly ignored his views in the summer of 65. The population question, JDR III wrote to Lodge, is the most important subject which you would have to discuss with His Holiness, assuming that you have a close and informal relationship. One gets the impression that Rockefeller never got over the fact that the Pope never took him up on his offer to help co-write Humane Vitae. Rockefeller wrote to Lodge in 1970, explaining that, quote, still today the Church could make a major contribution if it were willing to make a positive statement. The Church's failure to make what Rockefeller considered a positive, quote-unquote, statement could hardly be ascribed to a lack of zeal on the part of Mr. Rockefeller. Within minutes of his brief meeting with the Pope in July of 65, Rockefeller was reproaching himself out loud for not having expressed his case forcefully enough. In an attempt to calm him down, Monsignor Paul Marcinkus, later head of the Vatican Bank, suggested that JDR write the Pope a letter expressing any points which might not have been made during the meeting. A day later, on July 16, 1965, JDR duly sent off his letter on, quote, the importance of the population problem and the role that the Church might assume in its solution. The incident read like a chapter out of an unpublished Henry James novel. The earnest Protestant American with his two newly invented contraceptives and a boundless faith that technology and progress will solve all of the world's ills confronts the head of the old world's seminal institution, an Italian gentleman by the name of Montini. There is no problem more important facing the mankind today, Mr. Rockefeller informed the Pope earnestly. If the Pope failed to heed Mr. Rockefeller's advice, we will face a disaster of an unprecedented magnitude, right, quote. Mr. Rockefeller then went on to explain his invention to the Pope, calling the IUD a breakthrough of truly major proportions, making available a method which is safe, effective, inexpensive, and feasible under the most difficult living conditions. Experience with its use to date indicates that it will prove highly acceptable to a great masses of people everywhere. The IUD was driven off the market in the U.S. within a matter of years as a result of product liability lawsuits. Those who claim that the Church missed a historic opportunity by issuing Humanae Vitae would do well to ponder the consequences for papal credibility, much less infallibility, if Paul VI had taken Mr. Rockefeller's advice and endorsed the IUD as a means of Catholic-approved birth control. When it came to giving advice, JDR was used to the undivided attention of religious leaders, who in general seemed to benefit financially in direct proportion to how avidly they implemented his agenda through the agencies of their denomination. The Quakers, whose idea of missionary work included installing IUDs in Mexican women, are a good example in point. It was perhaps the accommodating nature of the mainline Protestants which led JDR to dispense with niceties and get blunt with the Pope and point out to His Holiness what might happen if the Pope failed to see things JDR's way. As I see it, Rockefeller wrote to the Pope, quote, If the church does not supply this leadership, there will be two consequences. One, the present accelerating pace toward population stabilization will proceed, country by country, without overall guidance or direction, particularly on the moral side. On the other, if I may speak perfectly frankly, the church will be bypassed on an issue of fundamental importance to its people and to the well-being of all mankind. The flooding tide cannot be stopped or even slowed, but it can be guided. Because I believe so keenly in the importance of the role which your church has to play in our troubled world of today, I am deeply concerned to see a situation developing which in the long run, it seems to me, inevitably will be harmful to the church's position around the world. One wonders what was going through the Pope's mind as he read those lines. Was he supposed to feel a sense of gratitude at being saved along with his church from being swept aside by the flooding tide of progress and history? Or was it something more like the Italian version of, if you're so damn rich, why aren't you smart? Either way, history shows that the Pope passed on JDR's suggestion. History shows just as conclusively that many liberal Catholics in the U.S. were much more willing to accommodate JDR's wishes than the Pope was, especially if the institutions they ran might benefit from the largesse of Rockefeller funding or that of other foundations. Father Hesburgh, who arranged the meeting between Rockefeller and the Pope, is a good case in point. In his letter to the Pope, Rockefeller wanted to know if it were possible to shift the focus of this concern from the method itself to the uses to which the method will be put. Would it be feasible to state that the Church will leave it to the discretion of the individual family of its choice as to the method it will use to determine the number of its children, provided the method is not harmful to the user, and provided it does not interfere with the meaning and importance of sexual union in marriage? This, of course, was the position the Population Council took as the condition for sponsoring its conference on population at Notre Dame. Father Hesburgh had proved to be as amenable on this point as the Pope would later prove intractable. Mr. Rockefeller's visit had other consequences as well. It convinced the Pope that his main enemy now lay to the west, and not to the east, and brought about, as a result, the end of the anti-communist crusade and the beginning of the Vatican's Ostpolitik, again, East Politik. On June 26, 1966, less than a year after the Pope's meeting with Rockefeller III, Agostino Casaroli, the generally acknowledged architect of the Vatican's Ostpolitik, flew to Belgrade and signed an agreement normalizing relations between the Vatican and Yugoslavia. Since sex was simply an instrument, something like a knife, according to the Rockefeller view of things, quote, could not the full weight and prestige of the Church be brought to bear on prescribing the circumstances under which the chosen method will be used? To express the above more concisely, what I am suggesting is that specific methods be regarded as mere instruments, like knives, whose use is morally good or bad depending on the intentions of those who employ them. It was a sort of consequentialism which Father Charles Curran would advocate roughly 2 years later in a book published by the University of Notre Dame Press. The Pope was, however, not buying. The Catholic Church did not buy the view implicitly in 1968 with the issuance of Humanae Vitae, and it still did not buy it 25 years later, this time explicitly with the issuance of Veritatis Splendor. Of course, the Catholic universities and theologians brought into the Rockefeller view at around the same time that Father Hesburgh arranged Rockefeller's meeting with the Pope, or they bought into them at that time. They made their break with the Church explicit when Hesburgh issued his Land O'Lakes statement in the summer of 1967. Rockefeller went on to add that dissemination of contraceptives would diminish recourse to abortion, implying that he opposed the practice, when in fact he was already involved in funding abortion advocacy in the United States. What he was proposing as his contribution to the Pope's birth control encyclical would later come to be known as consequentialism, the notion that the good or evil of any action is ontologically free of its essence and solely determined by the intentions of the moral agent and the consequences which flow from the act. This would become a prominent feature of Catholic dissent as the decade progressed. It would be the cornerstone of the proposition of Charles Curran, the man who would mount the most effective protest against Humanae Vitae in the United States, and it could be picked up at any number of conferences being sponsored by foundation money in the United States. JDR didn't succeed with the Pope, but his arguments were heard with increasing frequency coming from the mouths of Catholic theology professors. In October of 1965, the whole series of conferences on contraception at Notre Dame, which began under the aegis of the Population Council in 1962, and whose continued funding was provided by the Ford Foundation, finally emerged from the secrecy under which they were held with the issuance of what George Shuster had promised Rockefeller 3 years earlier, namely a statement by Catholic academics contesting the Church's position on birth control. In October 1965, Religious News Service announced the publication of a, quote, remarkable statement on birth control prepared this spring by 37 American scholars, the very existence of which was not revealed until 7 months after it had been written. Catholic scholars, at least 37 of them, were now on record in calling the Church's position on contraception, quote, unconvincing. The statement had been delivered personally by Reverend Theodore Hesburgh to Reverend Henry Reed Matten, Secretary of the Papal Commission on Birth Control, Henri de Reedmatten, R-I-E-D-M-A-T-T-E-N, Secretary of the Papal Commission on Birth Control. The story broke in the Paris edition of the New York Times in an article written by John Cogley, which included the text Hesburgh carried to the Birth Control Commission as well. Not surprisingly, the Notre Dame statement, which was hammered out from March 17th to March 21st, 1965, claimed that, quote, the crisis of world population was the main reason that the Church's teaching had become unconvincing. The statement went on to list a number of propositions endorsed by the members of the conference, specifically, you know, four bullet points. The members of the conference, respectful of the authority of the Church, are convinced that the norms established in the past are not definitive, but remain open for further development. Point number two. The members of the conference do not find convincing the arguments from reason customarily adduced to support the conventional position. These arguments do not manifest an adequate appreciation of the findings of physiology, psychology, sociology, and demography, nor do they reveal a sufficient grasp of the complexity and the inherent value of sexuality in human life. That's point number three. The majority of the members were of the opinion that there is dependable evidence that contraception is not intrinsically immoral, and that therefore there are certain circumstances in which it may be permitted, or indeed even be recommended. That's point number five. Finally, point number seven. The members were persuaded that in matters of public policy in a morally pluralistic society, Catholics, while rendering witness to their beliefs, need not, for reasons of private morality, oppose governmental programs of assistance and family limitation, provided that the consciences of all citizens are respected. Says Jones again. The last point was especially important. It was one of the suggestions laid down by the Population Council as a condition for funding the 1962 Notre Dame Conference. Now, mirabile dictu, miraculous to say, it appeared as if a group of responsible, quote-unquote, Catholic scholars had arrived at the same conclusion all by themselves, simply by pondering the exigencies of Catholic theology. With all of the crucial links in terms of funding and personnel tucked invisibly behind the scenes, the fact that the same ideas kept cropping up in such seemingly unrelated places was simply ascribed to the fact that great minds think alike. As we shall see, the notion that Catholics should not oppose government funding of contraceptives would soon rear its head again before the summer of 65 was out. The ideas which came out of the 65 conference were, of course, not the sole property of Rockefeller and the Population Council. By the summer of 1965, a consensus was emerging which had a number of interested parties involved. One of the signers of the Notre Dame statement, for example, was Notre Dame graduate and trustee Thomas P. Carney. Carney was, at the same time of the conference, vice president in charge of research and development for C.D. Searle Company, S-E-A-R-L-E. And Searle was a major pharmaceutical house which was involved in marketing the birth control pill at the time. When the deliberations of the Notre Dame Conference on Birth Control became public, one person who was particularly outraged at Notre Dame's duplicity was a lawyer from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, by the name of William Bentley Ball. Ball was also legal counsel for the Pennsylvania Catholic Conference, and it was in this capacity that he wrote to Archbishop John Kroll, K-R-O-L, head of the conference, and ordinary of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, claiming that the conference at Notre Dame does not make my task any easier, Ball related the experience of a Catholic physician who attended the conference and was sickened by what he heard, quote unquote, which involved a unified attack on the position which your excellencies have taken, even to the point of referring to me in a prepared paper. The conference, Ball continued, was chaired by a Notre Dame graduate named Carney, who is vice president of Searle, perhaps the leading manufacturer of contraceptives in the United States. When it came to the discussion of birth control at Notre Dame, the field was hardly level, nor were the observers disinterested. In addition to academics eager for grants, pharmaceutical companies like Searle had representatives at the conference to ensure a favorable outcome from their point of view. Notre Dame seems to have been happy with the collaboration as well. In 1967, Thomas Carney, who graduated from Notre Dame 30 years earlier with a degree in chemistry, was appointed to the Board of Trustees. In 1969, he was given an honorary degree. In May of 1971, he was awarded the Edward Frederick Soren Award, the highest award granted by the Notre Dame Alumni Association. The Catholic press, for the most part, took the belated announcement of the secret Notre Dame conference as if it were an encyclical from the Pope. Quote, "For the first time in my reading experience, at least," wrote Monsignor George W. Casey in the Boston Pilot, quote, "a committee of responsible moral theologians and sociologists meeting under Catholic auspices have made a public declaration giving endorsement, however qualified, to contraception." Monsignor Casey was much taken with the boldness of the Notre Dame statement, even if it had been hammered out in secret 7 months before. The fact that it was being publicized in the fall of 65 meant for him that a change was in the offing. The fact that people could say things like this and suffer no consequences meant that the teaching must be in doubt. In other words, the Monsignor was reacting more to how the statement was propagated and how it was disseminated through the media and how the church reacted to that dissemination than to the content of the document itself or the reasoning behind its assertions. The fact that the statement was signed by experts who claimed to be Catholic in effect took care of the problem of content, since most people would not presume to call themselves experts. The reaction to the Notre Dame statement was also a tribute to the loyalty which Catholics had toward institutions sponsored by the Church. In the minds of most people at the time, there was little difference between Notre Dame and the Church, a fact which the foundation sponsoring the conference used to maximal effect. The combination of residual trust in Catholic institutions, along with the sense that the Church was changing as a result of the Council, along with the population explosion drumbeat that Rockefeller and others were orchestrating in the media, all contributed to the sense that some sort of glacial, unstoppable movement was in progress, and that one's attitude toward contraception was some indication of whether one sailed with the tide or got swept away in the flood. "Signs are mounting," Monsignor Casey opined with specific reference to contraception, "that the reform and the renewal instituted by Pope John will be best remembered from what it does or doesn't do with regard to this agonizing problem." One indication that the efforts of Rockefeller and the Population Council were having their effect was the fact that the government was starting to get involved in their side of the issue. Johnson's endorsement of the population control in the 1965 State of the Union message was followed 6 months later in June of 65 with Griswold v. Connecticut. Then, following Griswold, throughout the summer of 65, Senator Ernest Gruening of Alaska chaired a Senate committee which held hearings on what was coming to be termed the population explosion, quote unquote. The hearings were orchestrated with two major effects in mind. First of all, the populace was to have the dangers of overpopulation impressed on it in the direst terms possible, and secondly, there was to be virtual unanimity among those addressing the Gruening Committee. The fact that there were no dissenting voices was to give the impression that a consensus of the best and brightest already existed on the issue, and that the only thing left for the Senate to do was put the recommendations of the population control Solons into action, similar to climate change. The predictions were nothing if not dire. The teeming masses were portrayed as an imminent disaster, something on the level of nuclear war. Deluge was a term frequently heard. Senator Gruening himself was of the opinion that if our population growth does not stabilize, we may reasonably assume that we will lose the freedoms, privileges, and good life we enjoy today. Senator Joseph S. Clark of Pennsylvania, bringer of the New Deal politics to Philadelphia, whose second wife was on the board of Planned Parenthood of Philadelphia, had become by the mid-60s a tireless proselytizer for government-funded contraceptives. "In my opinion," said Senator Clark before the Gruning hearings, "with the exception of the problem of war and peace, this is the most critical matter which confronts our country today." Robert C. Cook, president of the Population Reference Bureau, told the Gruning hearings that the point of demographic no return was not far in the future. For the uninitiated, the point of demographic no return was, quote, "that moment when mushrooming population growth makes disintegration and despair unavoidable." General William H. Draper, Jr., vice chairman of Planned Parenthood World Population, told the committee that he conceived a population as a bomb which must be diffused so that mankind does not multiply itself into oblivion. "Like cancer cells multiplying in the human body," Draper continued, changing his metaphor but not the pathological condition it hoped to portray, "it will, unless slowed down, destroy our present-day civilization just as surely as would a nuclear conflict." Not surprisingly, given the attitude that Gruning was trying to foster, John D. Rockefeller III, chairman of the board of the Population Council, was called to testify as well. And just as unsurprisingly, JDR told the senator from Alaska that, quote, "no problem is more urgently important to the well-being of mankind than the limitation of population growth. As a threat to our future, it is often compared with nuclear warfare." On the evening of the August 10, Ball watched the NBC Evening News with Huntley and Brinkley and listened to Stuart Udall, formerly of the Department of the Interior, and Alan Guttmacher of Planned Parenthood, announced that the hearings were proceeding smoothly and that so far no opposition had surfaced. That, of course, was precisely the point of orchestrating the hearing so that only the pro-population control side got heard. But Ball, who was responsible for representing the church in the state of Pennsylvania, was wondering if the people at the National Catholic Welfare Conference in Washington hadn't fallen asleep at the switch. Was it really true that the Catholics were planning to sit this one out? Ball wondered. A few phone calls indicated that this was precisely the case, and he was taking the time to register his alarm with Archbishop Kroll. Ball had contacted William Bud Considine, the legal counsel for the NCWC in Washington, only to find out that the NCWC was, quote, "staying out of this," because they felt, so Considine said to Ball, that the bill wasn't going to pass anyway. Ball was dismayed at what he heard. With the summer drawing to a close, it looked as if the hearings would conclude with not one voice expressing any opposition and not one representative of the church allowed to testify, not so much because Gruning refused to permit such testimony, but rather because the National Catholic Welfare Conference decided that it had nothing to say on the matter. The more Ball probed for answers on this perplexing matter, the more alarmed he became. After his initial contact with Kroll, and after receiving permission to testify on behalf of the Pennsylvania, Ball contacted Monsignor Francis Hurley, who attempted to discourage Ball from following through on his intention to testify. Speaking as a representative of the Pennsylvania Ordinaries, according to Hurley, would create friction in other states where welfare departments had already instituted birth control programs under the anti-poverty program with the express consent of bishops in those areas. Hurley felt that the position Ball was planning to take would be an embarrassment to those bishops. As the date set for Ball's testimony neared, it became clear that Hurley's objections were more than just procedural. The procedural maneuvering, i.e. Hurley telling Ball that NCWC wanted to pick its own time and place to take a stand on birth control, was complicated by the fact that they claimed to be waiting for directives from Rome on the matter. Behind both procedural objections, there was the matter of substance. Hurley in particular, and the NCWC in general, did not agree with Ball's confrontational attitude on government involvement in contraception. The sticking point was again racial, or at least this was the excuse given for not opposing what was going on at the Gruning hearings. Hurley wondered if it were right to kill the anti-poverty program just because it included elements that promoted birth control. Hurley, in other words, accepted the poverty programs at face value, whereas Ball saw them as a front for expanding the power of the secular state at the expense of the church, and beyond that, something inspired by the even darker motivation of eugenic suppression of the Negro birth rate. The impasse was never resolved. Ball continued to think of Hurley as an intelligent dupe who was out of his depth because he wasn't trained in the law. As a result, Ball felt that Hurley should not have been negotiating for the church. Because the impasse never got resolved, mistrust started to build on both sides. Hurley and the NCWC put forward their own candidate as a spokesman for the church, a Jesuit at Georgetown by the name of Dexter Hanley. Ball and Kroll, for their part, began to feel that the NCWC was working to undermine their position. On the eve of Ball's testimony as a spokesman for the Catholic bishops before the Gruning hearings in August of 1965, Ball announced to Kroll that on August 12, the Economic Opportunity Act had been amended to include, at Senator Clark's request, specific authorization for birth control projects. Ball used the rest of his letter to complain bitterly to Kroll about how the NCWC was handling, or failing to handle, the whole issue of government funding for contraceptives, a policy whose blame he lays at the feet of Monsignor Hurley, point by point. 1. The NCWC never opposed the introduction of birth control into the anti-poverty program. 2. Monsignor Hurley's personal position, which appears to be carried out in NCWC policy, is that the church should not oppose publicly financed birth control. 3. He approves the enclosed family planning statement by Father Hanley et al. 4. He expressly disapproved the view against family planning expressed by me in Commonweal. 5. He thinks that I should not testify at the Gruning hearings upon behalf of any bishops, but solely as an individual. 6. The NCWC has taken no position at the Gruning meetings. During the time in which the NCWC did nothing, ostensibly while awaiting further instructions from Rome, the Gruning Commission spent the entire summer giving the impression that the case in favor of government-funded contraception was virtually unanimous. As the summer passed, day by day, with no response from the Catholics, Ball can hardly contain his amazement. Quote, "I cannot believe," Ball told Kroll, "that after 50 years of preaching against birth control, the bishops of the USA have handed Planned Parenthood a total triumph. Yet that is the fact. There is little point in protesting the use of state funds for birth control by the Pennsylvania Department of Health when national Catholic policy has sanctioned such use." Ball was scheduled to testify before the Gruning Commission on August 24, but it was clear that he felt demoralized from the lack of support coming from the NCWC in Washington. Quote, "I am woefully tired of being a self-starter insofar as the NCWC is concerned," he told Kroll. "The basic weakness, of course, lies in the fact that the horse seems to have gotten out of the barn already." On the eve of Ball's testimony before the Gruning Committee, Kroll wrote to Vagnozzi again, complaining specifically this time about Father Hanley, S.J., who had testified on August 9 before the Family Law Section of the American Bar Association on, quote, "problems of public policy arising out of tax-supported family planning." As Kroll had come to expect, Hanley's position, which was sympathetic to the idea of tax-supported family planning programs, was widely publicized and was, as a result, widely regarded as the Catholic position on the issue. Kroll went on to complain to Vagnozzi that this sort of misinformation was making dramatic inroads on the way Catholics viewed the issue. He cited a Gallup poll in 1953, which claimed that 53% of Catholics said that birth control information should be available to anyone who wanted it. In January of 1965, 78% of Catholics polled expressed the same view. Similarly, 60% of Catholics felt that the church would approve of some method of birth control, like the birth control pill, and 81% believed that approval would come within the next 10 years. Vagnozzi, for his part, can only respond by sharing, quote, "Your Excellency's concern about the attitude of some individuals with regards to the Holy Father's directive on birth control discussions. Unfortunately, these persons or self-styled experts are succeeding in creating a false impression as to the Church's position on the subject. Frankly, I think there should be more concern." "As you say," Vagnozzi concluded, "this is a serious problem." It was clear from their correspondence that both Kroll and Vagnozzi felt that the misrepresentation of the position of the Church and the ban on discussion, which was, in effect, only being followed by those who adhered to Church teaching, was having serious repercussions among faithful because of the malformation of public opinion by the pro-contraceptive media. This, in turn, was having serious ramifications in the realm of public policy. The only countermeasure which the Church was able to mount during an entire summer of contraceptive propaganda, Kroll told Vagnozzi, would be Bill Ball's testimony, which was scheduled for the morning of August 24th. When Ball finally arrived at the subcommittee hearing room at the Capitol on the morning of August 24th, he was surprised to find that he was no longer testify as scheduled. He had been replaced in the lineup by none other than the Reverend Dexter Hanley, S.J. A look at Father Hanley's testimony gives some indication of why Gruning found his views more congenial than Ball's. Father Hanley began his testimony on a note that was Catholic enough. He claimed that, quote, the only morally acceptable form of voluntary family regulation is through continence, either total or periodic. Any public program which will either directly or indirectly challenge these premises will meet opposition from Catholics. But after saying that, Hanley effectively took the teeth out of the Catholic position by claiming that it affected them alone and that, in a pluralistic society, the good Catholic would not seek to impose his will on society as a whole. Hanley's idea of, quote, a practical and political accord meant, in effect, the marginalization of the Catholic Church on the issue of birth control and the further secularization of culture and its concomitant decline in social order. Catholic opposition to contraception was portrayed as the moral analog to their refusal to eat meat on Fridays. While it would be ideal, Father Hanley opined, if all citizens could share the same basic moral codes and convictions, the fact that they don't somehow means that Catholics should withdraw their objections to anything which the secular state wants, but which the Church opposes. Government, Hanley claimed, is not the proper organ to decide the truth of conflicting views. Quote, hence, while firmly maintaining my basic moral positions as a Catholic, I believe that I can support a government program which, in its legitimate concern about education, health, and welfare in a rapidly expanding population, permits each citizen a fully free moral choice in matters of family planning and aids him in implementing this choice. Now, it may be that Father Hanley hammered out his position in his room all by himself with nothing but an open copy of Denzinger before him, but the fact remains that there are remarkable similarities between his position and the position Mr. Rockefeller and the Population Council specified as the necessary condition for the grant he gave for the Notre Dame Conference in 1962. The other fact which remains is that Hanley was invited to precisely these conferences, so in all likelihood he knew the quote-unquote progressive position on the matter of birth control, and he knew the position that would ensure Catholics a welcome response from people like Rockefeller on the matter. It didn't take a genius to figure things like this out. In fact, it would take a moron not to figure them out, and Father Hanley was not a moron. Beyond that, Hanley's position had the blessing of Monsignor Hurley and the bureaucrats of the NCWC, who were increasingly inclined to push their own agenda at the expense of the teaching of the Church, and beyond that, inclined to make policy behind the bishop's backs. The insertion of Hanley into the lineup at the Gruning hearings was just one indication of them pursuing their policies at the expense of their employers, the bishops. Bill Ball did eventually get to testify on August 24, but as the last speaker of the day. As if that weren't bad enough, the fact that the Church's position was, in effect, represented as two different points of view, his and Hanley's, gave the impression that the Church was of two minds on the issue of government-sponsored birth control. In the face of an artificially orchestrated unanimity of opinion on the part of the secularists on the danger of a population, quote, bomb, which was about to go off momentarily, the Church's position seemed vacillating and unsure by comparison. Of course, that was only the case if one ignored Ball's actual testimony, which was a powerful indictment of government-sponsored birth control plans as both detrimental to the citizens' freedoms and covertly eugenical as well. Hamstrung by both the Vatican's prohibition on the one hand and an increasingly prohibitive notion of the separation of church and state proposed by the secularists on the other, Ball did a brilliant job of portraying government-sponsored birth control as a threat to civil freedoms. Ball's argument was based on two Supreme Court cases of recent memory. From Griswold, he established the right to privacy, and from the Engel and Schemp cases, he talked about the freedom from government coercion when religious issues were concerned. If the Supreme Court could argue that prayer or Bible reading being offered in school was intrinsically coercive to those who did not share the Judeo-Christian view, and therefore an impermissible infringement on the separation of church and state, then a social worker probing his client's views on sexuality and procreation could hardly be construed as less invasive or less of a breach of that separation. This was true of anyone on welfare, according to Ball, but it was especially true of Catholics on welfare or in any other capacity affected by a public entity. According to Ball's testimony, the main features of the bill pose serious dangers to civil liberty while offering no genuine prospect of relieving the problems of poverty, crowding, and disease which they purport to solve. Beyond that, birth control programs were necessarily coercive, as that term was defined in the recent school prayer decisions. This was so because the main target in birth control programs had always been the poor. Telling a person he is free to reject the proffered birth control is not ameliorated by adding that he is free to refuse. The very fact that the government, which is the source of the person's livelihood, is offering the services means that the government feels that the contraceptive is a good thing to offer, and by extension that the welfare recipient would do well to accept. The exchange is by nature coercive. For the Catholic, the state is intruding into a sphere around which it has just erected a very high wall of separation. If the court were sincere in its concern over the separation of church and state, it doubtless would have accepted Ball's argument. With the benefit of hindsight, however, it is difficult to see how the government was being sincere in this matter. The doctrine of privacy, invoked by Justice Douglas in 1965, 7 years later was used to justify the decriminalization of abortion, but it was not used to stop the government's ever-deepening involvement in funding contraceptives. The lesson seems plain enough in retrospect. Privacy meant, in effect, the protection of sexual liberation against the threats posed to it by organized religion. Eventually, the doctrine of privacy would be invoked to protect two homosexuals caught in flagrante delictu in an automobile parked on a street in Albany, New York. The doctrine of privacy in this instance was used to strike down that state's law prohibiting sodomy. It was just one more example of how the terms the secular state used to widen the acceptance of sexual liberation could never be used at face value to threaten the aforementioned expansion. In this regard, one could fault Ball for naivete, but that would invite undue cynicism, especially in light of the evidence of the time. In 1965, it was not apparent that Justice Douglas was not sincere when he referred to marriage as something sacred and private in Griswold. Ball was simply using the language available to him as a lawyer in a country that ostensibly placed great regard in the notion of rule of law. Ball also mentioned the fact that in recent times, both the courts and the legislatures had simultaneously broadened the definition of social welfare and narrowed the power of government over individuals. Common to both features was a quote, concern for the weaker members of society. Most recently, this concern has been more emphatically extended to the criminally accused, the alien, the Negro, and the poor. Gruning's bill was calling for something which went contrary to both trends. S-1676, according to Ball, is plainly and simply a bill for the establishing of a domestic and international birth control program and for the creating of a permanent federal government organs for carrying out the same. Ball complained that not only would such an entity be of its nature intrusive and coercive, he went on to say that the onus of its intent would fall on the Negro. The note of racial eugenicism, Ball continued, in quotes, is inescapable in the proposal of S-1676. In this hour of the painful emergence of our Negro brothers into the American society, surely this consideration should be weighed in the balance with the assumed but unproved benefits of S-1676's birth control proposal. Ball concluded by saying that the whole bill reflected the psychology of, quote, the white man's burden and should be rejected as a result. Ball's approach to the birth control issue seems to have taken the secular establishment and its Catholic Amen corner by surprise. John Cogley, who can safely be categorized as representing both bodies in his capacity as religion writer for the New York Times, was favorably impressed by Ball's testimony, at least at first. In an article which appeared 2 days after Ball's testimony, Cogley not only mentioned that Ball, quote, heavily relied on decisions of the Supreme Court, in his presentation. He also gave the impression that the argument about the intrinsically coercive nature of government-funded birth control was persuasive. Ball's decision to fight fire with fire seemed to be bearing fruit, at least in the impression it made on Cogley at the New York Times, who seconded the notion that someone's rights were bound to be violated and that someone would invariably be the client. The fact that the citizen, Cogley opined, was in the position of client of an all-powerful government put him in the danger of being susceptible to subtle pressure. One gets the impression that Cogley was expecting a frontal attack on the morality of birth control conducted by Ball in the name of the bishops, and that when this did not occur, he was caught a bit off balance. Within a matter of days, however, Cogley changed his mind about Ball's testimony and went on the offensive by accusing Ball of making it under false pretenses. Since he couldn't very well go back on what he said about the content of Ball's presentation, Cogley decided instead to attack the auspices under which he spoke. Cogley intimated that Ball was lying when he claimed that he had spoken on behalf of the American hierarchy. Cogley's article was full of innuendo and unnamed sources, but the intent was clear. Discredit the messenger by claiming that he did not represent the Catholic position. Quote, "At least one member of the administrative board of the National Catholic Welfare Conference," Cogley wrote, without naming names, "the only body that can speak for the American bishops, had no knowledge that the statement was to be made with the conference's authorization. On the Sunday, August 29, 1965, immediately following Ball's testimony before the Gruning hearings, Patrick Cardinal O'Boyle delivered a sermon on birth control and public policy at St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington. The sermon got widespread coverage in the press, and its influence was felt in Washington. The church, in the person of Archbishop O'Boyle, was taking a stand on the poverty program in the attempt by the government to deal with the plight of the poor in general, and the Negro poor in particular, through eugenic means. The sermon was a clear attempt on O'Boyle's part to draw a line in the sand, and the line had to do with the insinuation of birth control programs into the budget of the war on poverty. In the United States," O'Boyle began, "progress in the field of racial and social justice has been nothing short of phenomenal." O'Boyle's sermon was intended to put Washington on notice that no matter how phenomenal, no matter how holy a cause the civil rights movement had become, the Catholic Church was not going to tolerate it as a front for advancing public acceptance of birth control. Implicit in O'Boyle's challenge was a rebuke of the accommodationist policies of the NCWC up until that time. Committees of the Congress and other public bodies, O'Boyle said, hearing no official expression to the contrary, have assumed that silence gives consent and have initiated programs intruding on the private lives of citizens, programs in which, to put it bluntly, the government has no business. In addition to breaking with the policies of the NCWC, O'Boyle called into question the whole notion of a population explosion, conceding at the very most that there well may be at this moment areas of relative overpopulation in certain parts of this country, the so-called Negro ghettos of some of our northern cities, for example. Even if this were the case on a widespread basis, O'Boyle made it clear that birth control, especially in programs sponsored by the government, was not going to alleviate social problems. A program of such dubious benefit is clearly outweighed by its negative side, which involves a threat to the American family, specifically as a result of, quote, "the gradual intrusion of government into the private lives of its citizens." Taking his cue from Ball, O'Boyle cited Supreme Court cases to bolster his arguments. Justice Brandeis's right to be left alone was given a modern application in Griswold v. Connecticut. Now, concluded O'Boyle, if the government is enjoined by this decision from forbidding the practice of birth control, it logically follows that it is likewise forbidden to promote it. O'Boyle then went on to attack the Gruning bill specifically, if not by name. Quote, "In spite of these unmistakable constitutional roadblocks, a bill is now before the Senate Subcommittee on Foreign Aid Expenditures that would formally and directly involve the federal government in birth prevention programs, including the dissemination of information and materials at public expense. In a number of cities, there have been attempts to link promotion of birth control with the new anti-poverty program on the theory that, as one senator put it, the poor are more likely than any other group to have large families." That, O'Boyle thundered from the pulpit, is not the government's business. The choice of how many children a couple should have is the sole personal responsibility of the spouses. It is not less their responsibility if they happen to be poor. The line in the sand was clear. The church would support the civil rights movement's war on poverty and the concomitant expansion of the welfare state only if that expansion remained within the bounds of the moral law. Once that line was crossed, the government could expect opposition from the Catholics. This, of course, is precisely what the secularists had feared all along. Rockefeller and his minions at the Population Council were only interested in Catholics who were willing to relegate their moral beliefs to the realm of personal predilection. This had been the sine qua non for funding the contraception conferences at Notre Dame, and it was the heart of Hanley's position in front of the American Bar Association and the Gruning hearings. It was also at the heart of the NCWC strategy, which Kroll suspected, had gone out of its way to insinuate Hanley into his position into the Gruning hearing lineup in place of Bill Ball. O'Boyle was, in effect, arguing for an honest interpretation of the separation of church and state, and on sexual matters, this is precisely what the church would never get because, in virtually all important aspects, the separation of church and state was nothing more than a pretext for the establishment of the secular agenda as the law of the land, and sexual liberation as a front for eugenic control was, as time would show with increasing clarity, one of the secularist non-negotiable demands. For a government agent, O'Boyle stated, to inquire respecting details of their sexual life or in any way to suggest to them practices respecting sex which may do violence to their religious beliefs is a clear violation of the sacred right of privacy which the Supreme Court held to be inviolate. O'Boyle was arguing, in other words, that it was inconsistent to ban prayer as a violation of religious beliefs, but at the same time promote contraception. This was, of course, true, but it was also true that this self-contradiction lay at the heart of the secular agenda. In great issues of this kind, O'Boyle continued, where opinion is sharply divided, the first and most important consideration in searching for a solution is the preservation of the God-given right of conscience. Catholics, for example, have no right to impose their own moral code upon the rest of the country by civil legislation. By the same reasoning, they are obliged in conscience to oppose any regulation which would elevate to the status of public policy a philosophy or practice which violates rights of privacy or liberty of conscience. The citizen's freedom cuts both ways. In situations like this, involving serious moral issues in which people strive to form a right conscience, the role of government is clear. Strict neutrality. The moment the government presumes to give advice in this delicate area, it opens the door to influencing the free decision of its citizens. And from influence, it is only a short step to coercion. Unfortunately, Archbishop O'Boyle, like all the bishops, was fighting a war on two fronts on this issue. In addition to warning the government away from funding birth control programs, he had to admonish the Catholics to adhere to the church's position. A Catholic, O'Boyle claimed, turning his direction to the second front for a moment, accepts voluntarily, by the very fact of his membership, the official teaching of the church in matters of faith and morals. And, my dear good people, the church's teaching with regard to contraception has been both clear and consistent. As an indication that the teaching was not going to change, O'Boyle quotes the statement of Pope Paul VI, that, quote, we do not have a sufficient reason to regard the norms given by Pope Pius XII in this matter as surpassed and therefore not binding. If next week, O'Boyle asked in concluding his homily, you were asked to sacrifice one of your children to ease the population explosion, which one would you choose? Surely in the glorious history of this great nation, we have found better guides to the great society than the four horsemen of artificial birth control, abortion, sterilization, and euthanasia. This is the philosophy of defeatism and despair. In a letter expressing satisfaction over the reception of his sermon, O'Boyle mentioned the outrage of his mentioning the Great Society in a negative light caused. The light, of course, was only contingently negative. If the Johnson administration continued on its current course, it would have to deal with the church casting doubt on its moral bona fides. But O'Boyle nonetheless decided to take the criticism to heart, and in future publications backed off any mention of the Great Society. The message was clear without it anyway. Over the fall of 65, Ball, Kroll, and O'Boyle collaborated on a policy designed to thwart the entrance of the United States government into the field of birth control. On October 29th, Ball had a 4.5-hour meeting with O'Boyle in Washington, during which he laid out three possible responses to the birth control issue. The first response was peaceful coexistence, which Ball characterized as the position advocated by Monsignor Hurley in the NCWC. The arguments in favor of this policy were the ones the liberals found most congenial, namely ecumenical cooperation, civil peace, and avoiding jeopardy to the anti-poverty program. Pursuing this policy would cause minimal damage to the interests of the liberals and benefits from the welfare state, because it, in effect, would remove the Catholic Church from the fight. Option number two was the policy of limited opposition advocated by Father Hanley. This policy would resist government birth control programs unless provisions were made banning coercion, protecting privacy, and excluding abortion and sterilization. Ball was skeptical about both strategies, feeling that the birth control movement was already gaining power to the point of being uncontrollable by any means, and that government funding would make them so powerful that they would effectively be beyond any legal apparatus designed to control them. His objection to limited opposition policy was of the same sort, and he cited his experiences with Planned Parenthood as an indication that legal controls of the sort Hanley was urging, even if accepted on paper, would prove worthless in practice. In applying for a $90,000 grant in Philadelphia under the Economic Opportunity Program, Planned Parenthood targeted the plan for a 100% Negro area in the north-central part of the city. In addition to that, the people staffing the program were not medically trained, but had been trained to pursue Planned Parenthood's social program. According to the grant application, the home visitors trained by Planned Parenthood to go to the houses of their, quote, clients, to, quote, note the conditions under which the family lives and to seek the information necessary for effective future programming. If grants were funded under those conditions, it seemed foolish, according to Ball's reasoning, to expect such programs to be neither intrusive nor coercive, no matter what the safeguards. As a result, Ball advocated a policy of, quote, full opposition, but not without first adding a few caveats. Full opposition was going to be uphill work because birth control had become a billion-dollar industry, which was willing to spend a considerable amount of time and money to create a mentality in favor of government funding for its services. Kroll, who had serious doubts of his own about both the effectiveness and the loyalty of the NCWC staff, seemed undeterred by the grim picture Ball painted. Without hesitation, he opted for the strategy of full opposition. In a letter dated November 2, 1965, responding to Ball's description of his meeting with Archbishop O'Boyle, Kroll agreed that the policy of peaceful coexistence and even the policy of limited opposition would be a waste of time and effort, and implicitly conceding victory to our opponents. Full opposition is the only reasonable course left open. Within 2 weeks of Kroll's decision, Ball was in Rome giving a confidential briefing to the general body of bishops there on the dangers of government-funded birth control and the best strategy in dealing with it. Perhaps because he could speak his mind without fear of reproach from the media, Ball sketched out a very cynical picture of the war on poverty. The Economic Opportunity Act, the main funding vehicle for anti-poverty programs, had become, according to Ball, quote, a major artery for government birth control in the United States. This money was directed exclusively to the poor and would be used against them in ways both coercive and intrusive. Ball cited the $90,000 program proposed by Planned Parenthood for the North Philadelphia ghetto as an example. When Ball returned from Rome, he had not only the support of the key bishops, but the blessing of the Holy See as well. Dealing with Catholics in the Johnson administration was to prove more difficult, though, than getting a blessing from Rome. On December 13, 1965, at 3:45 p.m., Ball met with Sergeant Shriver, head of the Office of Economic Opportunity, to discuss the bishop's concerns. Remember, he's related to Kennedy, Sergeant Shriver. Ball immediately got to the point. There was, he said, strong support among the bishops for the anti-poverty program, but deep dissatisfaction over the use of the program to promote birth control. Ball then challenged the legal authority of the birth control funding directly. There was, Ball said, no legal authority to use the program to fund birth control in terms of statutory interpretation and construction. Shriver, in other words, was acting illegally and had been acting so all along. Implicit in the statement was the threat that Ball, acting on behalf of the bishops, might take the OEO to court if Shriver did not prove amenable to less contentious means of persuasion. Shriver responded by dismissing the threat from the church and making it clear that he felt he faced an even more potent threat from the left. As a result, he, quote, could not venture to defer even for a moment the approval of pending applications. Shriver made it clear that the OEO would approve any birth control project that had been recommended by a local anti-poverty council. Because of the inaction of the NCWC at the program's inception, a precedent had been set, and Shriver could not go back on that precedent without indicating that he had been acting illegally all along. Shriver continued by saying that he was anxious to make a good record by funding as many applications of every sort possible prior to the end of the year. When asked by Ball whether he could hold off until February 1st, Shriver replied in the negative, indicating that he was under pressure from Dr. Guttmacher of Planned Parenthood and others who wanted funding for projects which involve financing for abortion and sterilization. In addition to that, Shriver informed Ball that he was under pressure from Protestants and other Americans United to defund any projects sponsored by the Catholic Church. POAU felt that any involvement of the church in welfare activities supported by the government was a violation of the separation of church and state. Shriver refused to accede to POAU's demands and tried throughout the interview with Ball to portray himself as a man who was trying to tread the reasonable middle ground in the issue. But it was just as evident that he was defining the middle in terms of the political forces being brought to bear on him at the time, and in the absence of a strong policy on the part of the NCWC, he was being pushed considerably to the left of what the Catholic bishops found acceptable. As a final attempt to sway Shriver, Ball brought up the fact that the Congress had refused to adopt the Clark Birth Control Amendment that September, and that this reflected Congress's intention to exclude birth control from the poverty program. But Shriver was not only unmoved, he also went over to on the offensive by warning Ball that the more the church raised a fuss over the birth control issue, the more unlikely it would be that her agencies would be included in the poverty projects. On that not-so-veiled threat, the meeting ended. Ball left the meeting convinced of two things. First of all, after talking to Shriver and his assistant, Ball was convinced that the authorization for birth control was lacking, and secondly, that Shriver and the OEO would continue to fund birth control programs because reversing themselves in the matter would expose them to greater legal and political jeopardy than continuing would. As a result, Ball drew a number of conclusions. Most significantly, he concluded that further attempts at persuasion were pointless and that the bishops should look into the possibility of litigation as a way of making their point. Given the Congress's veto of the Clark Amendment, this approach stood a good chance of success. Beyond that, Ball concluded that the bishops missed a golden opportunity in the beginning of 1964, but even with that as the case, they had no choice but to take a stand on the OEO birth control programs because, quote, if no resistance is offered to the OEO programs, Planned Parenthood should soon be in business at public expense throughout the USA. Once programs like that got rolling, they would only increase in scope to include abortion, sterilization, and birth rationing. The idea that everyone should be made sterile unless otherwise permitted by the government to have children. It was an idea that was making its way through the media through the efforts of people like William Shockley, who received the Nobel Prize for inventing the transistor, and then promptly used that as a platform for increasingly strident calls for racial eugenics. As before, the church was outgunned on just about every front, but Congress's reaction to Ball's testimony and O'Boyle's sermon gave reason for hope. The hope proved to be short-lived. According to Ball, the bishops had a historic opportunity in the fall of 1965, but largely as a result of the foot-dragging of the NCWC legal staff, the winter months passed and the church has taken an historic non-step. By May of 66, Ball felt that many will look back with horror upon what can only be described as an historic default. Especially galling from Ball's point of view was the fact that the NCWC was fleeing from a very beatable opponent, from, quote, a legion of Kapok dragons, as he put it in a letter to Krall. If the church were able to present the case that government birth control created a threat to the right of privacy, Ball felt that a large segment of public opinion might be won over. But Ball found himself more often than not engaged in a one-man campaign, while at the same time Father Charles Whelan, S.J., with the backing of the NCWC, was claiming that it was absurd to fear government's involvement in the birth control issue. The Hanley-Whelan faction, Ball complained, was so fearful of imposing Catholic morality on others that they were opening the door to abortion, sterilization, and racial eugenics, all in the name of making peace with the liberal social agenda. Disbelief is the characteristic emotion of Ball's increasingly exasperated correspondence with Kroll. "This whole question of government birth control has become to me a thing like death," he writes. "You look at it and you can't believe it's so." And that ends part 3, chapter 11, all about birth control and the Catholic essentially standing by while the Protestants and Rockefeller pushed forward with it and making a mistake. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll carry on with part 3, chapter 12.